Hello, this is Esperanza Phoenix, and welcome to Unpacking Life's Crazy, a podcast about a lifetime of unfortunate, unusual, and enlightening experiences, and how some of us use humor and hope to survive mental illness. In our podcast, we discuss controversial and adult topics. We are all adults here. There will be swearing. Today, we have an interview with Aiden Park, who is a friend and an awesome guy, and he does some stand-up comedy, and he is here to share about his new book, The Art of Being Yay.
Yay!
So, tell me what's going on with you. Like, it's been forever since we just talked, and I think the last time we really saw each other was when I was leaving the Bubble Biz.
Are your listeners up on the Bubble Biz thing?
They are, because we had that lovely interview with Johnny Korn.
So we should probably fill them in. Just
let's have a recap on the bubble thing. Among my many bizarre jobs that I have done, one of them was being a bubbleologist. And Aiden happens to be the wonderful guy who hired me to be a bubbleologist.
That's right.
So tell the listeners what a bubbleologist does.
Esperanza, did you read my book?
I have not had a chance. I didn't even learn about your book till last week.
I'm getting it because I can read it directly from... Wait a minute. I want to read you this because you're going to love this. Because you're going to relate so hard. Oh, business. Oh, yes. Bubbles. Oh, yes. You're right here. Okay, great. Yay! Okay. The book is called The Art of Being Yay. It's all about finding happiness through my many trials and tribulations. I was like a homeless HIV positive teenager when I was 19. I learned the tools of empowerment and dug myself out. And then I lost my husband. And then I tried to. So it's all about that.
But yeah, like the last time I was really talking to you was like right after you lost your husband. And during that.
Yeah, it was a tough situation. Bubbles, right. When I was 25 years old, I started working for a bubble guy for a children's party company. Isn't that the perfect job for me? I'm very bubbly. I'm like walking bubbles. Sometimes I drink, I'm closer to sudsy, but I'm still bubbly. And have you ever heard of a gayer thing? I went to children's parties and made rainbow bubbles and put kids inside bubbles. So that's what Esperanza and I did.
That's what we did.
And then Joseph, my boss, an amazing guy, Frenchman who embodies the American dream. And I suggested that we ought to expand to the Bay Area so he could double his profits. And he said, okay, Aiden, you lead the expansion. That's how I became the manager. Because it was only in LA, and I was like, you should expand. And he was like, if you lead it, we'll do it. And so, you don't know this, but for years, Esperanza, years, it was a bit. Like, I had to drive up there, like, every third weekend because all these flaky bubbleologists, like, flaking. And, like, I had, like, 7 bubble shows, and I was like, I have to go. So, like, every, like, third weekend, I was up there.
I had no idea.
It was such a bitch. It was, you joined us, like, 3 years in. But it was such a bitch. It was rough going in the beginning, we said. We had many quirky bubble employees who would flake. I would go to the Bay Area and teach people the scripts how to make bubbles. But we didn't initially have many customers, so employees would quit left and right. Also, the Bay Area is different. In LA, everybody has multiple jobs as they pursue their real passion. In San Francisco, everybody already had a full-time job in tech in order to barely squeak by. Few artistic types like you. have the time and the personality to make great bubbles. To find people who are good with children, could memorize scripts, had availability, and a car in the Bay Area is like finding an Asian in the early 1900s in New York. Okay. You're going to love because you met these characters and try to figure out who they are.
Okay.
I did manage to find some people who were willing to work for us for a short time. Allow me to list a few. Carl, a breakdancer who smoked a lot of pot, a lot of pot, and he refused to take off his beanie for his bubble performances. Okay. This is true.
Is he the one who got the bad review we kept hearing about?
Yes! He got so many bad reviews! So many! Esperanza, it was a nightmare. And then Sally, a clown in training who kept asking if she could wear red nose to the party. Okay. This girl, Marie, a tiny girl who drove this monster truck who eventually had plans to relocate to Mexico with her mother to escape the man. Oh my god, I guess I don't mention you. You in my stand-up comedy act, I say that I have an energy healer.
That's funny, because here I thought I was like so abnormal and stuff, and compared to everybody else, I was really pretty legit.
You're going to die when you hear this next one. You're going to die. You're just going to die, okay?
Okay.
Check Jerry, a former movie extra. Okay, because Esperanza trained him. Because I was, like, hard up. I was like, I have nowhere to train this guy.
Oh, so my God.
I brought him to your house.
Yes.
And I, like...
Oh, he was, like, the worst.
The worst! The worst! Okay, a former movie extra who said things like, I worked with Robin Williams once and he handed me a clipboard, and at that moment he looked at me and I knew he believed in me. I could just see it in his eyes. He was saying, you got it, kid. Am I totally not exaggerating at all? Like, I'm not exactly, that's what happened, right?
Oh, that guy was so weird. He, like, had no personality.
Esperanza, I was desperate. I was desperate. You quit. You said, I can't do this anymore. And so I had to find somebody. So that was the movie extra.
You needed somebody who could do a lot more shows than I could. And I just couldn't physically do it with the fibromyalgia anymore. And I just, I was like, I absolutely just couldn't do it. And then, of course, my limitation with my anxiety is like, I can't travel during rush hour. Yeah. How does that work for you guys? Because I just could not do it. It's like...
We made it work for like a year, though. A year. I'm just saying.
Yeah. I was fine with leaving a show during rush hour, because whenever I got there, I got there. No big deal. But to go to a show during rush hour in the Bay Area, I would just like wind up arriving like such a pile of nerves. It's like, how am I supposed to entertain people if I'm like going insane?
Didn't you have a run-in with like Safari Kids?
They were the worst. I definitely don't want to stereotype people, because I know that there's all kinds of people and all, you know, who have totally different personalities.
He's about to do it right now.
The people who were the meanest to me were these Indian women that were in charge of Safari Kids. They were always like super mean to me, and I don't know why. I mean, I met some very lovely Indian women in their homes who invited us in for the bubble parties and stuff, and they were great. But for some reason, the women in charge of these Safari Kids,
man.
Like, they wouldn't have the kids be quiet. They'd be having me shout the show because like everybody was running around like a mad person. And then it's like, oh, well, the show ended 5 minutes early. We don't want to pay you as much. It's like, it ended 5 minutes early because people were running around like nuts.
Yeah. Fucking Safari Kids, man. I remember. But I did Safari Kids. I think they treat men different.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like scary. I'm kind of scary. Like,
you're a tall, big guy.
Yeah, I'm like, sit down, you know, and then they're like, oh, you know.
I'm just like this little person, and I try to, you know, be accommodating to people and all of that. And it's like, you can't accommodate them.
Nice, Esperanza, but let's not push it. You're not like this pushover lady. So let's not, you know, be like, oh, I'm this little girl. No, Esperanza, not.
Well, see, I'm super nice to a point.
Yeah, but you know, you don't mess with her. Like, I mean, I never receive the other end of Esperanza's, but I just know you. I can feel it. You're like, you can't raise a transgendered, you know, kid in this current environment and have that kid turn out okay without having some strength.
That's true. Yeah. Don't mess with my kid, because then there's no... That was my biggest fear, actually, when Kira started coming out, because it's like, okay, well, we need to put that out, you know, now that she's ready to be public about this, where we need to let friends and family know, and everybody needs to know and be on the same page, because I don't want her to be misgendered, and I don't want them to use her dead name, and I want her to be able to feel comfortable and all of that stuff. But my biggest fear was that I would hit a relative or a friend who was not okay with that, because then it was going to get ugly, because I would have to defend my child. And, you know, I don't like conflict, but it was going to be a conflict. And so far, not a problem at all. I mean, I surround myself with people who are very accepting. Yeah. I mean, you know, when, like I said, actually, in my little teaser of this, when you and I had our very first conversation about the job, we like talked for 45 minutes or an hour about like everything.
That's right.
Everything. I think you said, oh, I'm Gaysian.
That's right. Well, I think what happened was like I said something, some inappropriate joke, because I'm a comedian and I'm you gotta make sure, was it you? Because I said, like, there's one girl who, God bless her, I love her, but she wore, like, low-cut shirts all the time to bubble parties. the moms would be like, that's such an inappropriate outfit for the bubble party. And she had cleavage hanging out. And so I said to you, you remember that? I was like, not wear low-cut shirts that exposes your cleavage. And please don't think that I'm me-tooing you and telling you what to wear because I'm a Gaysian. And I really don't care. I don't want to confuse you for feeding time. You know what I'm saying?
I have enough babies trying to grab my boobs as it is. I don't need to.
All those safari kids.
I swear, anytime I pick up an infant, the first thing they do is stare at my cleavage and start grabbing. It's like, okay.
They're prominent. They're prominent.
They are prominent. Yeah, we had this great conversation, and of course, you knew immediately that I don't care what flavor of gay you are.
Here's the truth that I found is there's a lot of, do I want to say this? Yes, I do. I travel all over the country, small towns, big towns, whatever, you know, and like to do comedy, stand-up comedy. And what I found is that people generally do not care if you're gay or straight or Asian or whatever. Mm-hmm. If you're there to have a good time, like, you know, they generally don't care. And I think sometimes the fear of the negative reaction gets politicized and leveraged to get votes, to make money, to whatever, whatever, and then rail against the thing that really doesn't, like, they just did a show in Montana. No one cared. That was my experience. So I'm not that scared, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, like you said, I'm a healer. I do some weird stuff, okay? And so I've been judged for my weirdness at various times in my life, not in the same way that being gay or trans or a person of color or whatever happens. But because of being bullied as a child, because of my own personal fears, I have a lot more fear about the people that I care about who are different being bullied or discriminated against or whatever. And I feel like when I am with someone who falls into the different category, I am on edge because I'm ready to defend them if any shit goes down. Like you said,
it used to be worse. Like back then, 20 years ago, and people say like, oh, like, you know, bullying is worse than ever. No, it's freaking not. This is the best we've ever had it. And right now it is not cool to pick on the gays, not cool to pick on the black guy, not cool. Like, you get ostracized if you are that person. So we've progressed forward, but us having grown up in a time where things were so difficult for us, and where it was cool to be a mean girl or whatever, we carry that forward. The world is like that. But now the world is such that if someone says, chink, fag, that is not cool.
Right.
So everybody hates you if you do that.
And if you get caught on camera being a Karen, bye-bye to your job.
Bye.
Yeah. We will cancel you.
Yeah.
And I'm up for that cancel culture, man. If you want to go out there and be a straight up bigot and get yourself caught on camera being a bigot, go back under your bridge, troll. Nobody wants, I guess the weird thing to me is I think some of these people live in such a bubble of hatred. They actually believe that the rest of the world feels like they do. You know, you'll see the people with like their big souped up truck with the hateful bumper stickers on it and the whatever, and they drive around with their flags like they think everybody's going to give them a high five as they drive by. And then they're shocked when they wind up being a viral video. And everybody's like, this guy.
So I ended up at a Black Lives Matter rally in Kalispell, Montana, because I live downtown Los Angeles and things were burning down. And so I was like, all right. When things started burning down, I was like, I've always wanted to go to Montana. Montana, here I go. So I just drove there. Because I was like, I need to get out of here. When I ended up in Montana, I ended up at a Black Lives Matter rally. And there were people who supported Trump. They're with rifles. But even those guys, I talked to them. Nobody was there saying Black Lives don't matter. They were saying things like Blue Lives Matter. Whatever. Because I would talk to them and all of them were like, of course police brutality is terrible. Of course police brutality is terrible. Of course police brutality. And of course we don't hate black people. Like, so even that is actually, I feel progress because I feel like it's no longer cool to be old racist.
20 years ago, that would have been what they were doing during the day. And at night, they would be putting on their sheets and hanging out, burning a cross. I mean, let's face it.
But I think we've just come forward.
Like you said, when we grew up, it was a lot different. my first love, who happened to be Black. He came to do a show in the community where I lived, small town, almost no diversity. And I remember, especially after a show, people would like to get together, go hang out to the bar after a show, you know, just hang out. And I remember one night everybody's like, okay, who's coming? We're going to go hang out. And we're going to go down to the Rawhide. And Ronald's like, oh, hell no.
Yeah.
Oh, hell no.
You know.
Yeah, and he had good reason, because during that time, there were pockets of Klan members up in the hills up there, and they would hang out at the Rawhide. That was like a hangout. So, yes, it is getting better. It is a lot better. But unfortunately, it is still institutionalized, and that's why we got the protests. Let's make sure that when you shoot anybody as the police officer, it is automatically an external investigation to figure out what went on. That would be a good start.
Yeah. I do think that there should be sensitivity training, and they get elevated, like, you know, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. It's tough. You know, I'm always, I don't know if I should say this, but I'm going to, because I always do. I always say what I'm, I think that police officers are put into a very difficult position as it stands right now. I think that a lot of them, not all of them, of course, there's people who join for whatever reason, you know, mm-hmm. but a lot of them join because they want to do good and they want to feel like whatever. So they join with the raging of defund police and almost, you know, the narrative of demonizing police officers, it mm-hmm. makes that job very undesirable. These people have to actually go out there and put their lives on the line to protect majority of the time.
But part of it is just the system itself is set up in the wrong way. For example, we only have the one, we only have, basically, you call 911, they send a cop, an ambulance, or a fire truck,
yeah.
or sometimes all three.
Yeah.
But a lot of the calls that cops are being called to are not inappropriate. They're not appropriate for a police officer to be showing up to in the first place. It's mental health issues. It's, you know, homeless person peeing in the doorstep. It's, you know, things like that that don't necessarily require somebody yeah. with a firearm and all this. You know, we need a whole lot more people responding with mental health situations. And
that's, I agree, yeah. it's not the individual police officer's fault.
Right.
Them into a villain role for a job that they're overextended, like you said.
Right.
They have to take care of the peeing in the corner. They have to take care of the drug dealers. They have to take care of the... And so they're perpetually in a state of, I can see their whole job is to be on guard because at any moment something could come.
The other thing is the way that we train them. Like in places like Norway, they have like 3 years of training where they get trained in de-escalating and how to deal with the mental health things and how to yeah. deal with all of these things, where a lot of our police officers have 6 months of training. And that's just not enough
right.
to deal with that.
I agree systemically.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But I think as the system, as it stands right now, we do need those police officers and we can't villainize all of them.
Right.
Are overextended and a lot of them do mean well, and so we can't just put them all in a category, and I think there should be systemic change, but I don't know, like, I think that job is hard.
It is hard. And another thing that would help is having people who are policing a neighborhood be from that neighborhood. You know, they know the people. I mean, we need to go back to having cops like back in Mayberry.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, that one guy was constantly getting drunk and being locked up for the night.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, no big deal. When I lived in Costa Rica, the craziest things would happen. Okay, so there a machete is a tool. They use it to trim their lawn. They use it to deal with their farm, whatever. A machete is a tool. So we had one guy whose wife was stepping out on him with this other guy, and they got into it at the bar. And the one guy went home and got his machete
yes.
and came back to the bar. And there was like this big thing. So the cops show up, they arrest the guy, they oh. take his machete, they lock him up overnight till he sobers up. The next morning, they let him go and give him back his machete. You know, here that would have been attempted murder. How long would he have gone to prison? Whatever else. And there they were like, oh, you know, clearly you lost your temper. You need your machete for work. Don't do that again. Have a nice day.
Yeah. And that's a problem also.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
So we got to...
There needs to be balance. There needs to be balance in how things are dealt with.
And balance.
And there just and isn't.
I'm not supporting police brutality. Please do not. Let's not do that. Like, because I said something positive about individual police officers, I'm probably going to get people who are like, oh, yeah, yeah. And I'm like, no, that's not what I'm saying. I'm not about police brutality. Please. Oh, yeah. Like, I'm going to be like, oh, yeah, police brutality is a good thing. Come on.
Ridiculous. Well, that's the other thing, too, that some people don't get. It's like, well, when we're marching in the street, most people who are out there aren't marching against police in general. They are marching against police brutality. So, like, stop beating people up, but stop killing them. And that's fine.
Yeah, also, like, you know, you talk to a police officer who lives in L.A. I'm like, I'm kind of like, I think, like, a lot of the police officers get a terrible rap. Like, I know people who've been on duty during the Black Lives Matter thing 17 hours in a row. No break policing with people going, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you. And it's like, come on.
There needs to be a balance, and having a process that deals with the police who are behaving badly and actually gets them out of there is going to make everybody look at the police differently as well. You can't give the bad ones a free pass and treat them like you do pedophile priests and move them precinct to precinct after shit goes down. You know?
That's hilarious.
You know what I mean? What was it Robin said? Hide the priest, where's the pedophile? Hide the priest.
But we don't talk about that. We don't talk about that because, you know, that's, oh, let's not talk about that. That's religion. We don't talk about religion, but police.
I talk about that.
Anyway.
All evil is evil. I don't care what uniform you're wearing, whether it's a dress or a cop uniform.
There's people who wear aprons, pretend to be chefs, and they're chopping people up. Have you seen Sweeney Todd?
Oh, yeah, that was excellent.
It's supposed to bring people joy with pies.
It did bring people joy, except for the people who were in the pies.
The worst pies in London. Angela Lansbury.
Oh, yeah, she was great. She was classic. Yeah. Although I did really like the one with Johnny Depp in it.
Yeah, that was
good. Nice. The movie was good. So let's get back to your book.
Yay!
Yeah, get back to your book. So, like I said, the last time we really had a heart-to-heart talk, first when we found out about the cancer diagnosis of your husband, and that was, and then to lose him so quickly, that was just,
I was over at your place training that guy. Hot mess. Remember?
Yeah. I remember I basically put you down for a nap afterwards.
That's right.
I put you in the easy chair and told you to rest because you were like running ragged and trying to do the training thing. And then you were still dealing with the grief. And it was just, did I do a treatment on you that day?
Yeah, kind of like a mini one.
I did a mini
treatment. Do you feel like my energy is better now?
Yes. Oh my God. Yes. Oh
really? Like a lot? Like, you feel like my energy is good. But so as an energy healer, you see me. Would you say, oh, that is somebody with good energy?
Yes. Yes.
Awesome.
Way better. Way better. Yeah. Oh, you were in just a really dark, such a dark place. I mean, obviously, you had every reason to be at that point.
Exactly what was happening. And I talk about this openly in my book, The Art of Being Yay. I don't know if I should start here or start somewhere else. Or
you tell me.
I'll give you a framework of what the book's about real quick, and then I'll get into the story, okay? So that people understand what I'm about, all right? So I'm going to truncate this as much as possible.
And I had no idea about the prostitution aspect.
Oh, yeah.
I had no idea about the HIV.
Oh, you didn't know?
No, I had no. I mean, it's not something I ask people, and it's not something you're required to tell me. Never came up. I was unaware.
I'll give you the drama of it all. I moved here when I was 9 with my single mother. She leaves to go across the country for a job due to some kind of extraneous. It's an unfortunate circumstance. I grew up alone with my grandmother who doesn't speak any English. So I'm basically I don't have a parent. I'm living in grandma's government housing, right? I get through high school, I get good grades, I get out, and I realize I can't go to college because I'm undocumented. So then I start Craigslist hooking until I get HIV. And then at that point,
wow,
people are like,
what year was that?
This was in 2003. Yeah. And then my friends around me are so concerned. And one wise person sends me to an empowerment kind of seminar workshop kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
from that point, I have a shift of perspective. I'm like, okay, like, I really, it's irrelevant whose fault this is. I need to take responsibility and I need to drive my shit.
Right.
So I start diving into educating myself with, you know, empowerment, and I do the best I can. So for
you're doing the work. You're doing the self work. I've talked about, I've done my own self work, totally different situation. But yeah, we got to work on ourselves. We got to, you got to fix your own head in order to move forward.
You can't do it without. So as a result of that, right, you met me before Michael died. So
my
having a bubble business and the political consulting business, which is something else that I do, and, you know, becoming like a headlining comedian and like a working actor, all of that came as a result of the mindset that I studied.
Right.
In empowerment. And I have a focus on the neuro-linguistic program, which is a tool for empowerment. And I'm actually a master practitioner. Oh. I don't know people because I didn't want people to think I was a weirdo. I was just doing it on me.
That's why I don't do healings.
You know what I mean, though? It's like,
yeah, people are like, okay, that's a little woo-woo. Yeah.
Oh, that's cool, but whatever. And then my partner of 5 years.
Yeah.
And so what happens is you caught me at a really low point. It got a little worse after that, but I hit my rock bottom right after our meeting of that day.
Well, the night before, I remember you had been like off the rails at some party situation that you mentioned. Right. It was part of the reason why I sent you to take a nap, because I was like, oh my God, you cannot be on the road.
And I'll totally tell you exactly what happened there. Okay, so let's go back there then. So okay. My husband, you know, I don't know. Have you met Michael?
I never got a chance to meet him, though.
I'm pretty specific about I know what I want as far as like a man, like, you know, like, and what I like in myself and what I like in the guys I date. I like a sense of surety, like, and that only actually comes from having hit such a rock bottom that you stop caring. You kind of end up being like, this is who I am and that's it. And this is what I like and that's it. And there's a surety about those guys who kind of realize I'm living for me. I'm not living for you. I'm not living for the construct. I'm not living for society. I'm living my life for me. That's it.
Right.
I've reached that point now. But when I lost Michael, I lost my shit. I mean, I talk about it in my book. I like overworked. I started going to because I was suicidal. After Michael died, I was like, I don't want to be here. I don't want to be here. I just want to die. Just want to die. After that, after a little while of contemplating, you're like, oh, well, I guess I'm not going to kill myself.
Were you still at the, you know, if a bus happens to hit me, that'd be a good thing?
Phase? Yeah, I would get up.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I wish I were dead.
Yeah.
At one time, I had several panic attacks after Michael died.
Uh-huh.
People think he was also, I would like to clarify this. People think he was my sugar daddy because he was older. He was not my sugar daddy. I was on a carb-free diet. That's what I like to say. So
I know that because you and I have discussed it. Because
you know what I mean?
People make assumptions.
Listen, deeply in love with that man. We were in love. Okay, I was in love with. I would have died for him. I actually still think like. Well, I mean, I don't know. I worry about him because like I feel like if he had stayed and I went, I'm not sure that I don't know how he would have handled it.
Yeah.
I'm glad I'm the one that's left because I'm kind of like I feel like I can manage. I have more resources as far as friends and stuff like that.
Right.
I feel like a little. I don't know.
He was more of the anchor homebody.
Right.
In the relationship.
Totally.
Yeah.
I was more of the gatherer. So like as far as, you know, I went out there and gathered and I made whatever. And then he kind of anchored. Right. So
right. When
we are shaken up, we have a tendency to lean into whatever our strength is. After I decided I wasn't going to kill myself, I was like, all right, then I won't kill myself, but I'm not going to fucking feel like this for the rest of my life because I can't live like this. There's no fucking way I'm going to ever.
Right.
Like I can't. But then what happened was my first strategy, which you caught me in the middle of, was what's the first tactic that people take when they want to be happier? They go, let's fix everything on the outside.
Right. Let's put ourselves out there. I kind of did the same thing after my husband left. It's like out at every party, like keep yourself busy, work as much as you can. As many projects as you can find, just fill that empty space with something.
Something, anything.
Something.
And I'm glad that I had that experience, but it did lead me to taking on way too many jobs. I was doing 3 comedy shows a night. I was going out every night with my friends. I was trying to date guys, which I was leaking trauma all over them. Like I would go on dates and they'd be like, hi, my name is Chris. And I'd be like, hi, I'm Aiden. Do you have a copy of your most recent health report that your doctor sent me? Do you have anything in your family with cancer? Like, leak trauma all over them. And then, of course, after all that fails, I totally turn to drugs, like in a heavy, heavy way. And I got involved with a man, we'll call him Mel, because that's what I refer to him as in the book, you know. I came to you after I spent about 5 days with Mel, and we were both heavily intoxicated, heavily drugged up. He was also wonky because he had just gotten out of a 20-year marriage with a woman and coming to terms with the sexuality. There was a lot going on. There was a lot of insecurity and hurt, and it was a very toxic relationship that I was.
And that is a really weird place to be as the rebound guy for you, is this guy coming out of a 20-year marriage with a woman, rebounding to you as the first gay relationship. That's not some healthy stuff going on.
Well, the thing was that we represented something for one another, right?
Right.
So in a way, I was always the kind of like the gatherer between me and Michael. And so Michael had a true, true heart. But as far as resources, I was the resource gatherer. Does that make sense? Like money?
Right, whatever. Right.
And he supported. Mm-hmm. This guy was very financially well off. He was like really like high level executive for a major hospital. You know, working on systems, and he's great. I mean,
I think you may have mentioned that when you were here that day.
He's a really talented, really business minded, and for me, I felt at that time like he's providing something for me that Michael did not at the time, and I was like, I was just looking for any kind of security, and I'm grateful for him because in some ways I feel like without him I might have completely collapsed.
Yeah.
And I had something. Yeah, it was wobbly and unhealthy, but it did lead me to my self-discovery. Oh my God. Okay, so this story gets crazier.
Okay. So you had that wild 5 days, ended in a, like, I think you said you were like up till 4 or 5 in the morning or something. Yeah. And then you're at my place training the lamest bubble guy ever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I put you down for a nap, basically. And we didn't really have a conversation about what happened next.
Yeah. So he and I were in that kind of position. And I also provided for him. Like, he always wanted, like, and he was really into Asian guys. And he's not great with people. He saw me do stand-up comedy, and I was, like, the headliner or whatever. And then he kind of, liked that energy being next to whatever. So we fed on each other. It collapsed. So he had a tendency to lie and manipulate. I have a tendency to get a little paranoid because of my hurt.
Right.
And so that's a bad combination.
Yes.
Because I use him for things that I'm not sure if he did or not, but some of the things he did, and then he would say, I never did it, and then gaslight. So
right.
I'm always in a position of, what am I seeing? What am I hearing?
What's real and what isn't?
Yeah. And we were both fucked up on drugs. So that was a bad situation.
Right.
The rock bottom actually came when he actually bought me a trip to Europe. We were going to a 10-day trip to Europe. That's the thing, right? Like, so like he would do things for me that he could financially. So he would buy me nice things and he would support me business wise. Like, oh, you should set up your website this way. Gave me a lot of great ideas.
Right.
I have to thank him for that. He's really brilliant and he's really nice guy at heart. And he wanted to show that he cared in his own way.
He also needed to do his own work on himself.
Correct. We're both hurting. Yeah. And so I thank him for those things. And, you know, that should be credited.
Right.
But we were going to go to a trip to Europe. And I found out something. It was one of those things. Okay, like, so, you know, how I told you I never am sure what he did or what he didn't do. Like,
right.
So, like, I would watch him do things like check out other people blatantly in front of me. I would catch him. Then he would say, I didn't do anything. It was all you. But then it made me go, and I've never seen anything like that. And it always happened, like, right after the show where I was introducing myself to people.
Mm-hmm.
And he felt ignored. So he would go off and do this in a way I would see it. So, and eventually it all came to a blows. Like,
so just manipulative kind of bullshit.
Kind of.
Like head game stuff.
Yeah. And then he'd be like, oh, what's the matter? But I would catch him doing that. And then I would see the person that he was doing that to reacting to him. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it wasn't in my imagination. When I would confront him, he made it like I was crazy.
Uh-huh.
And I wasn't trusting him very much, you know, and I found out something that I thought I wasn't sure about. And so I canceled the trip. I was like, I'm not going. It was the day before. And I was like, I'm not going on this trip with you. I do not trust you. I don't trust your intentions. I just don't.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a lot of drama. But also at the same time, 10 days with a person when you're on edge like that.
I don't need to go to Europe and be in that position.
Exactly.
You know?
I mean, traveling is kind of stressful anyways. You got to know your travel partner. And if you're starting the journey with that, yeah, that would be incredibly stressful.
So then there I am. My first Thanksgiving after Michael's death. We always do something special for Thanksgiving. Alone in my apartment with nothing to do. What do you do? So that's, I really hit a rock bottom. And I was like, whatever I'm doing right now is not working. Me trying to fix the outside, getting a boyfriend, going out friends and work and do all of that was not working. It led me to have 3 panic attacks. It led me to have, you know, this situation. It's not working. What do I do? And I felt so bad that I was like, I just want to feel better. I don't care. And then I started thinking, I was like, can I short circuit? Because I have empowerment tools, right? So I have like neural linguistic programming, all of that stuff I can do. And so up until that point, I was like, I'll use the empowerment tools to affect change in my external circumstances in order to raise my happiness level. That strategy after Michael died, right? Go out, have lunch or whatever.
Right.
Then at that point, I was like, that doesn't work. Can I short circuit to try to just get an emotional result instead of something tangible? So instead of going for money, instead of going for a boyfriend, let's go for an emotional result, happier.
Right.
What does that mean? And so I started actively researching happiness and what that means and positive emotion and what that means and how to use what I know in the tools of empowerment for an emotional result. And that's when my life changed. That's what the book's about, because I'm like, wow, holy crap. No one talks about it. No one understands their emotions. People don't know how to handle it. If you get happy first, everything else follows. This book is an accident. So I just talked to my friend who just kind of, you know, set up a meeting with this woman who does book coaching. And she gave me a scholarship to write this book, like for a program.
Wow.
Things started happening. I got like more TV acting jobs than ever before. Like, but it only happened after it got happy.
Right.
And I've learned how to get happier moment to moment. I'm happier now since even before Michael died. So Michael died, I was at like a 5, 6, 7 generally because I'm on the bullshit. I was like, oh, but I don't have this, or I'm not on this TV show or whatever drama I'm constructing, right?
Right.
But now I don't construct drama. I know what I need to do to raise my happiness level. I know how to take care of myself emotionally. I have an understanding. And so that's the greatest gift.
Yeah, yeah. But it's also driven by resilience in you. I mean, there's a resilience in being able to go through what you did when you were younger and then going through the HIV thing. And so you were gathering those skills as you went along. And luckily, you had those in your quiver when this all happened again, and you were able to pull those out and take it to the next level.
There's this amazing book that really changed my life, okay? And I recommend it for everybody. It's a little scholarly, but it's such an important book. It's called Grit by Angela Duckworth. And Angela Duckworth studies success and achievement.
Uh-huh.
And what she found is the number one indicator, like number one predictor of success in people is resilience, grit.
Right.
And so after I listened to that book on Audible, I applied that to literally everything I did, including the bubbles. So bubbles got hard. Like, you know what? Like these difficult times, the resilience through it, there will be a payoff. Oh, like I had a bad set. Great. This is what you do. And that book really changed my position. And I'm lucky to have the kind of personality that doesn't sit back. I go for it. If I'm going to do it. So if I'm going to try to make myself happy, I'm going to be full-heartedly going about it. It caused me some pain, but it also caused me a big learning.
Right.
So I'm grateful for that experience because I'm happier now than I've ever been, right? And would not have been possible without, you know, Mel.
Right.
Or all those meltdowns. Or actually, it's almost like Michael leaving Like,
it moved you forward. It wasn't how you would have liked to move forward.
No.
But, you know, all of the experiences that happen wind up being stepping stones on that path. They're stepping stones on that path. And sometimes those stones get spread the fuck out and you're like walking through a swamp trying to jump from slippery stone to slippery stone. And you're just like, fuck it, I just want to drown myself. But if you can keep climbing and you're willing to keep looking for that next step and that next step and that next step, you can use them as tools.
You know, the one thing that I think is the most important thing, if I, you know, like if anybody hears this and, you know, maybe they can help themselves anyway, is the idea that, you know, we all want what we want because of an emotional end that we think we'll get. So even my training people for bubbles. Why? Because if I have a successful bubble business, I'll make a lot of money and then I'll feel a sense of safety and security as far as my monetary. So like what we're going for is safety, security.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is a way to get it. And that's great. But when that is frustrated, like if I'm missing Michael and I'm like, oh my God, I miss Michael. If I can catch myself and go, what is it that I would experience if Michael were here right now? What would mm-hmm. he provide me? And sometimes it would be comfort, safety. Like a comforting word, a safety. So then the new assignment becomes, well, Michael, as a way to get that emotional end, is no longer available to me. So let's take responsibility for getting that emotional need met directly. So
right.
How do I give myself security? How do I give myself comfort? And taking care of yourself in that way really strengthened me, because I learned when I have a negative emotion, not to make an enemy of it. It's like, what is it that I need right now? What is it that I need right now? Let's give myself the need, you know?
Right. Fulfill the actual need, not finding the person who would have fulfilled the need in the past.
Yeah. You can't. I mean, I couldn't, no. Right?
Not only that, but people tend to think that it is the external that gives them the feeling, but they are the ones feeling it. You are the one that's producing that feeling, that serotonin, that epinephrine, that whatever. You're the one producing that as a reaction to the stuff around you. And to some extent, you can control how you react to the things around you. Are you going to like have a hissy fit because there's a fly buzzing around you? Or are you going to ignore it or get a fly swatter? I mean, you can choose how you react to inconveniences, how you react to social stimuli. You have a lot of control over that. And people seem to feel very much reactive, and they'll be like, oh, he made me mad.
Yeah.
No, you chose to be angry about the situation.
Right.
You know that guy's an asshole. He's always an asshole. So you chose to expose yourself to him. He's acting like an asshole. And now you're angry about it.
Yeah.
So what are you going to do to either remove yourself from the situation or accept the fact that he's an asshole and ignore it?
Yeah. It's just such an ease to just accepting everything. Like, I mean, you're an asshole. You get this. Like, it's just like, you know.
Well, I didn't always get this. I mean, this is years of therapy on my behalf.
Yeah. Like, everything's perfect. You know what I mean? Like, okay, like, Esperanza's perfect. Esperanza is just perfect exactly how she is. Am I going to ask her to run the amazing race with me? Probably not a good idea with her, you know, fibromyalgia. And then if I, you know, if I do that, and then it's like going on the amazing race with you and you having a hard time and me going, why aren't you doing better? You get to choose. People are exactly how they are. Everything's exactly how it is. This thing is red. My shirt is black. I get to choose exactly where to put it. And that's my responsibility. That's it. But if you just accept it, accept everything as it is, it's such a powerful tool it gives you so much power, doesn't it?
Yeah. And it also empowers other people by accepting them for who they are. I actually had that conversation with my daughter, Kira, when we were talking about her transition. The reason parents have disappointment in their children is because they put unfair expectations upon them.
Right. Or any expectations, really.
Our expectations on, people in general, our expectations of other people is what causes us to be disappointed or whatever. Let people be them who they need to be. You be who you need to be.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly when it comes to children, I thought I had a boy and a girl. Turned out I had two girls.
Yeah.
I'm okay with that because I didn't have any specific expectation of who they would become. And sometimes we put too much, you know, we put too much on other people. And it is very much how we choose to react, how we choose to be and accept.
Yeah.
So you got a grant to do this?
Well, actually, her name is Enette Morton. She saw me at a comedy show, and she, you know, ran the business department at Pepperdine University. And I've always been interested in business and all of that. I never went to school, so I just like learn from whoever I can. Right? Uh-huh. So she and I have been friends for years. She saw me after Michael died, was worried. A few months later, saw me with a kind of really very improved attitude. And she was like, what happened? Told her what happened. She referred me to a friend who's a book coach to maybe get some ideas about writing an article or something. Uh-huh. And that friend heard my story, was like, you're going to write a book about this, and I'm giving you a scholarship with my program.
Wow.
That's how it happened.
So the scholarship was for guiding you through the process? Or yeah,
guide me through the process.
Through the book writing process.
Yeah.
So when did you start that process, the writing?
August. Was it August? August or July of 2019.
Okay. Yeah. So it's been about a year in process. And when was the book released?
The book was released in August, but initially wrote a book. The first version of the book was completely finished by November of 2019. And I read it and I was just like, I don't know. It just didn't feel right. I found an editor and think about what it lacked. And I started all over again from zero and wrote a brand new version. And that's the version that's out now.
Okay. Yeah. And it just so happened that I reached out to you to say, hey, I have this podcast. Do you have anything cool you want to talk about?
You reached out to me because you were just like, oh, I'm here. Like, listen.
Yeah, like, listen to this. And my next thing is I'm luring my friends onto my podcast. And no, because I mean, I know a lot of cool people who are comedians and entertainers and all of that stuff. And I was going to be like, hey, listen to this. And hey, do you have anything you want to come just shoot the breeze about what's going on in your life or whatever? Because you're interesting. And then bam, you have this book. I was like, wow, I have not yet gotten to listen to it or read it yet. So now that's on my to-do list.
Yeah. And Art wrote my foreword, but yahoo. So that's what's been happening, Esperanza.
Well, I am so glad to see you. Well, nobody else can see you because I've got the video here, but they can hear your voice because I was worried about you. It was some dark times, and I'm glad to see that you've pulled yourself out of that and found your happiness and created a manual so hopefully other people can find their way out of the dark too.
Yeah. I have a question for you.
Yes.
Energy healer. So do you see energy or do you feel energy or how do you do this?
I feel energy. And I also have like an intuitiveness about it where it's not really. Okay. So like my last interview is with this guy, Eli, and I met him doing stand up. And it's like the moment I met him, there was like this click. I was like, I know you. I connect that energy. There's something about you that I just get.
Yeah.
And that will happen where I just certain people I just have this connection with and I jive with their energy and I don't even really know how to explain it. But when I'm doing an actual healing, sometimes it's like when I'm speaking with them, I can feel a sadness or I feel a pain. There's something about it. And it's like I want very much to put my hands on them.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of times I just ignore it because that's weird and I don't know them well enough to say anything about it. But if they're a friend of mine or they're a friend of a friend and I am able to broach that subject, then I will oftentimes offer to do a hands-on energy balancing on them. Yeah.
Well, I'm very public, so I want to ask you, what do I have any blocks? What would you recommend for me? What should I do? You tell me.
Well, I'm going to tell you that you are immensely better. You'll see a tiny little bit of darkness there.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it's tied with the book, the ambition or anticipation of where it's going to go from here. Maybe it's just because we're in this pandemic thing and everything's crazy. I mean, there's a lot of that going on where we've all just got kind of this background of not quite all the way there. But you're going to keep moving forward.
Interesting. Okay. So where is there an origination of that dark energy? I want to ask you your opinion on it. Where in my body do you see it somewhere?
It's in your head. It's all in your head. It's all in your head.
It's all in your fucking head.
It usually is.
Really?
Yeah, like it just, I don't know. Maybe what I'm feeling is a slight bit of doubt.
Yeah, anxious as fuck. Because it's like, okay, like in the book, right? I'm like, nobody knew that. I don't talk about my past. Like, you knew nothing about it.
Right, right.
The whole HIV thing and the whole, you know, like my whole past history. Like, it's all out there, out in the open. It feels very raw. I feel,
yeah.
It feels very, it's a little scary for me. Yeah.
Right. Right. And that's natural. It's natural for you to have some apprehension about that. You just poured your guts out and, you know, stuff that, like, I knew you, but, like, your HIV status, that's not exactly something you just, like, randomly tell people unless there's a reason. I have another dear friend who, I think he's, like, 53 now, and he was diagnosed when he was 18, of all things, poor guy, years ago when it was even scarier. Yeah. And I didn't know we were friends for a long time. And then something came up and he mentioned it. And I'm like, really?
Yeah.
I had no idea. So it's, you know, people get treatment. So you don't know that about a person unless they choose to share it or they need to share it. So that's something where you're not necessarily keeping it a secret from anyone, but it's not necessarily something you want to go out there and blurt out on the street.
The only function I'm doing that, you know, for the support of the book.
To be honest about who you are. And sometimes those honesties are especially difficult to put out there. I talked about it in my podcast about, you know, trying to heal myself and putting it out there that, yeah, I have complex post-traumatic stress disorder because I was abused as a child.
Yeah.
I don't say that to everybody on the street. I don't go into detail about that.
Sure.
That's part of who I am. That's why I react the way I do to certain things.
Yeah.
And it's just a part of the story. Your HIV status, what you went through, that's a part of your story. And that's how you got to this point. At the same time, it's horrible. It's like, that's where you build resiliency is from surviving horrible shit.
Well, I mean, there's such hitting rock bottom and I don't, you've been there.
Yeah.
So you can feel me. When you reach that point and I hadn't been there yet, you know, up until I think there's a shift. Like,
how many times did you think you'd hit rock bottom before you really hit rock bottom?
Yeah. Rock bottom of, you know, when I was 19.
Right.
And maybe there's another rock bottom for me.
Yeah.
I don't know what I don't know, but I do know that I care a whole lot less about what I should be doing. It's like, you know, you kind of take charge of your life once you really get to that point where nothing fucking matters.
And you get to the point where you're like, this is who I am. If you don't like it, then fuck off.
Yeah.
You know, but even so, even though you're at that stage, I mean, we all want to be loved and we don't like to be judged. You know, nobody likes to be judged. So, but you're doing great. It's amazing. I am just so happy for you. And I'm so happy that you decided to come have this conversation with me, that I can share it with other people and hopefully they'll listen and learn something. And maybe if they're in their rock bottom, they'll realize that they're still an up.
It's good to catch up. I miss you. You know, I know we contacted each other with bubbles, but I've always, you know, like, freaking loved you. So
yeah. Well, you felt so bad when I had to leave the company. You were so sweet about it.
I did not want you to go. I really was so sad. From a practical end, but also emotionally. Like, I was attached to Esperanza, you know?
Yeah. Well, and also, I was extremely reliable.
Oh, you were. You were very reliable. Yeah, even with the safari kids.
Yeah, even with the safari kids. How long did that awful bubble guy last?
Like a show. I told him to make the thing with warm water and oh god, I hope he doesn't hear this. I told him to make warm water and he put like, I'm not kidding, like 150 degree water into like a bucket and then closed it, and then when he opened it, it was all blue because like it overheated. That was really bad. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
When it gets all cloudy, that's a result of heat. And so he was like, I don't know why my bubble's not working. Well, it's because you're adding like freaking, you know, sauna water. I said warm water, not, you know, scalding hot. We're not boiling water here. Like,
you're not making bubble tea.
I mean, Jesus Christ. And then like, I was like, okay, I'm going to get tools for him. I'm going to get the tools back. He was like, hey, by the way, do you have a massage chair? Because if you really need a massage chair, you know, you could use this code together. And I was like, you're trying to sell me a massage chair and join your pyramid scheme. Collecting bubbles. Yo, you're kidding me. I need to get the fuck out. Like, this is ridiculous.
That is so bizarre. No, I, you know, I wish that my body could take it, because some of those shows were the most fun. They were so fun. I loved putting babies in bubbles.
Oh, God.
You know, like you take like a 6-month old and you prop them, and you like, I created a bubble dome over a couple of the little guys. And one time I went to this party. It was the weirdest thing, because like, I don't know if all the kids went home for a nap or what, but by the time I did the show, there were only 3 kids total.
Yeah.
Some grown-ups, and there was like a 7-year-old, a 3-year-old, and one of the ladies had a poodle there.
Yeah.
I put the poodle in a bubble.
Glad you enjoy it, because honestly, if I never have to do a bubble show again, I'd be a happy man. I'm done. I'm so great at it. So if I have to do them to keep up my business, I will. But
it wasn't doing the show's part that was fun. It was the reactions from the kids. And the, you know, that was very sweet. I liked that part.
I'm just over it. I don't want to do it. But thank God for there's people like you who are still.
Well, I hope Johnny gets better, because I know he absolutely loves it. And I know he's missing the kids. So we're going to all get through this pandemic ridiculousness one way or another. We're going to get through this. The world will return to a lot more normal. And in the meantime, everybody, check it out. The Art of Being Yay. Maybe you will find a way to find your happiness.
Yay. Get the book. Oh, so there's a website. So I'm going to plug this real quick.
Absolutely.
At the end of each chapter, there's a QR code. You flash the QR code, it leads to a correlating video blog that guides you through about how you can use the principle related to each chapter for your personal life to raise your own happiness level.
Oh.
So there's that. And then on my website, there is a bunch of tools that you could use to kind of like self-evaluate. The thing about happiness is you can't get to happiness by avoiding unhappiness. You must face the whatever is causing you the grief and walk straight into it. In order to manage it, that's it. So my entire website is actually about being happy, you know, and tools to help people be happier. So that's AidenPark.com.
AidenPark.com.
Yeah.
And I will be, of course, providing a link on my website, the podcast section of my website, so you can go directly there. And I'm so happy that you had decided to have this conversation with me.
Me too.
Thank you so much, Aiden. You're awesome.
Thank you. I love you. Call me anytime.
I love you. We need to have more conversations, and look me up the next time you're in the Bay.
For sure.
That's going to do it for today's episode of Unpacking Life's Crazy. If you'd like to learn more about this episode, our guests, or anything else related to Unpacking Life's Crazy, check out the podcast page of my website, EsperanzaPhoenix.com. To support what I do here, please consider purchasing some of my artwork, either at my Etsy store, EsperanzaPaints.com, or at ESPPhoenix.redbubble.com. Last but not least, I want to offer a special thanks to Chelsea Wild, the talented musician who composed the theme for this podcast. To find more of Chelsea's wonderful music, visit minorbirds.info. Remember to subscribe if you want to be notified the next time we release an episode. And until then, take care of yourself and those that you love.